Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 310. How do you plan for the performance of your Python applications? What does a performance budget entail? And where should you spend your resources? This week on the show, we speak with Den O'Dell about his new book, Fast by Default: Practical Performance Engineering. Den has 25 years of experience in building web systems for companies with hundreds of millions of users. Working on public-facing tools has honed his skills in understanding where performance is vital and in guiding decisions based on data from actual users. Den shares details of his performance framework that works across any platform or stack. We discuss the need for budgeting performance during the planning phase, measuring performance through consistent profiling, and keeping systems fast even as your code base and user base grow. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Den, welcome to the show.
Hey, Christopher. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about performance engineering and your book.
Thanks.
I think we could get this out of the way right away that you're not a Python person. And I think that's totally fine because I feel like these ideas are actually at the heart of a lot of the updates and the work that's happening behind the newest versions of Python. They're working on removing the global interpreter lock and trying to get threads working better. And asynchronous stuff has been like the last 10 years. And then most recently, the just-in-time compiler being hopefully added in the newest versions that are coming out. So there's a lot of people working on speed inside of Python, let alone the rustification of libraries and things that work inside of Python. I think the stuff that you're going to share, especially with development teams, is going to be really kind of great, even for Python developers.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. So I come from like a web background, 25 years in the industry. And so, you know, a lot of my work's been in the browser, JavaScript, and TypeScript more recently. So yeah, it's been interesting, like writing a book that's about more general performance engineering when my history has been on the web. But I felt that it kind of needed to go there.
Yeah.
But, you know, being focused just on the front end and everything that happens, you know, after the server layer and into the browser and what the user interfaces with, that's all very important and stuff. But software is like, you know, the bigger thing, right? It's like,
yeah,
it's everything from the core up. It's everything from like the CPU all the way up to the browser and to what the user's working with. So it's all a big system that works together. And just to focus on one aspect of it, just to focus on the front end, is great. You solve problems, but that's not the whole system. And if you want to make a software system fast and performant and stuff, you've got to think about it, the whole system. So Python fits into that. JavaScript fits into that, you know, lower level stuff as well. And a lot of people building mobile apps and desktop apps as well. So this is all,
yeah,
it's all related. It's all stuff that's connected together. You know, the world is a big one.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I thought we could maybe start a little bit of a background thing. Like, what led you toward thinking about performance engineering? What kind of journey were you on to get to here?
Yeah, so it was not something that I was like, oh, I'm going to learn how to be a performance engineer and I'm going to spend my career learning how to focus on this one area. It's something that came out kind of naturally out of being like someone who builds products and user interfaces. And having, like I mentioned, having that longer history in the web world, 25 years, like browsers, oh, they're still quite slow, but they were really slow back then.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You needed to kind of eke out every little bit of performance that you could from them back in the day. So, you know, going back not even like 10 years ago, things are pretty dire. So I spent a lot of my time building products and then finding, you know, they don't work as well as you want them to. And having to go back and spend like a whole bunch of time fixing and you know, adapting and all this kind of stuff. And with the browser world in particular, you've got several browsers you need to support, not just one. So, you know, your runtime is several different ones. Just always an interesting challenge.
Yeah.
So I found my time was spent a lot in like all these kind of tweaks to do with performance and trying to make a user interface that's really nice to work with. And that's basically all kind of comes down to performance. A couple other factors as well, obviously design and accessibility and things like that. But performance is like the main one, the thing that when people are like, you know, using a piece of software, a website, app or whatever,
yeah,
if it's slow and unresponsive, you know, they're going to give up after not very long. And I'm the same when I'm using sites and systems that are slow. I just want to give up and I just want to tear my hair out and never go back to it again. And I spent most of my career trying to make applications that don't make you feel that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of like part of what happened there to get me more focused on performance. I never decided, yeah, performance is my number one focus or my only focus. It's always been like a thread that's run through, but it's always been a thread that's run through like all of my work from, you know, 10, 15 years ago onwards. I spent a bit of time at Volvo Cars trying to work on some web applications for them. That were very like image heavy and really weighing down the browser. So spend a lot of time trying to find ways to improve that, you know, in the front end, but also as I became a team, like a tech lead there, trying to think about ways where I could make it so that I didn't have to, these things that weren't always like the thing at the end of the project.
Yeah.
You know, you don't build and then do your performance optimization stage. I know a lot of people do it that way and you know, that works fine some of the time. But I was finding like over and over again that it wasn't working for me or for the teams that I was trying to lead. So I sat down trying to figure out what all the things that I could do and what I could bring to our way of building software that would mean that we can take some of these things and do them earlier. Or fit them into our process in a way that meant they weren't all at the end and we weren't suddenly discovering, like, after we launch something that something's slow, or suddenly discovering a week before launch that things are slow and that final week is like just this stress ball of trying to eke out all the little performance tweaks we could from something that was probably architected wrong from the beginning. You know, try to work these things back into the process so that next time we run a project, how can we do it differently? And that's kind of where this whole like idea of what I call fast by default came from, is trying to take all the things that we can that we would otherwise be doing at the end and feed them into the process earlier on.
Yeah.
And a lot of that's about like training developers to build things in a certain way that maybe they weren't dealt with before, spending more time thinking about architecture at the beginning than kind of seeing how it goes as you're building.
That's funny.
And yeah.
I have an analogy.
Oh yeah, great.
Yeah, in the world of cooking, you know, and chefs and stuff forth like that, you need to start with good ingredients. And I feel like architecturally, if someone's just using what they're familiar with or using, you know, what they've used in the past, or maybe what's been, well, this is all I can get, and it's not a great starting point, that you're kind of starting behind. Mm. You start with great ingredients, your food's going to just like be elevated right away. And I think your career has shifted a little bit in the sense that you've moved away from the specifics of this sort of stuff. And as you become like a team lead or move into management types of stuff, you have to distill like practices like, well, this is how I would find that this is a good tool, or, you know, I don't know if I need to say it's like, you know, 'cause I tried to do JavaScript for a while. I still mess with it off and on, but it was very dizzying 10 years ago to try to stay up with whatever was happening. There was like 7 different ways you could control your CSS stuff. And I was like, okay, do I do gulp, grunt, SAS, what do I do here? I couldn't stay on top of it.
I'm pleased to report there are now about 25 different ways of doing the same thing. So it hasn't gotten any better. There are just more options. But you know, sometimes more options is better because you can find the one that better fits your use case. But it's hard to stay on top of things in the web world in that way. Yeah, and the new and shiny, there's something new and shiny every week. And you know, the temptation is to just reach for that because that says it's going to solve this problem, or hey, you've got performance problems? We've got this tool for you. Why don't you try this out? I'm sure it'll be perfect. Yeah. And, you know, the thing is that you know, the new and shiny isn't always better. In fact, sometimes the really old stuff, the really older technology is the stuff that works the best because it's been refined over so many generations and years and stuff that's the stuff to rely on more. But, you know, ultimately, there's only a certain amount of stuff you can do in the browser, and I'm sure it's like the same on the back end and in mobile apps as well. Yeah, they keep adding new features and stuff, but ultimately, like the core stuff is the same. You know, the networking layer and the rendering. You know, there's improvements that they make, but ultimately, these are the layers that exist. And in order to improve performance, you know, they'll add new features here and there, and someone will come up with a great library, or someone will come up with a new framework that is good or better than before. A lot of the times the new frameworks are less about improving performance and more about improving developer experience and making it easier to write apps in the first place. And that's absolutely got its place for sure. Yeah, frameworks and libraries, you know, these are adding extra layers on top of layers that already exist. And if you can strip it back and get back to whatever the core level is for the browser, that's just, you know, plain CSS and plain JavaScript. If you can write in that, things will definitely be faster than using a framework. But, you know, there's other benefits that come with frameworks as well.
That's been your experience.
Absolutely, 100%. I've tried a lot of different frameworks over the years. And the more you strip back, the better for the experience. Now, the developer experience is a different matter. And you could argue that perhaps that's, you know, LLMs, coding agents that we have, like Claude Code and whatever, helping us to develop, that maybe it isn't as important with developer experience because you've got someone else doing the work for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's very interesting. It's also interesting that, just as an aside, that React is one of the frameworks that's very popular on the web. It's been around for more than 10 years, 12 years or something like that.
Yeah.
Very popular. Most people train in React. They don't really train in JavaScript anymore. They just learn how to do React and build React apps, and that's it.
They move up to the higher level.
Yeah, exactly. They go up the level. And so because there's so many tutorials and so much information about React out there, then the agents learn from that, and they think that that's better to use that than it is to use like core JavaScript or whatever. Whereas they could use core JavaScript. All the information's out there. They've learned it. They know how, but they optimize for, you know, the framework, because all the information out there is about the framework. And often if you're coming in and you write your first prompt, you say, hey, here's the stack I want to use. It's React. And it's you know, I want to use this library and that library. But if you can strip it back and just say, hey, I don't want to use anything, start me with the basics. And if I need to add something later, then let's add it on. But, you know, the less, the better.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I've heard other practitioners working with LLMs in the Python space doing something similar, like, oh, don't, you know, try to have it write it at, you know, the lowest level possible in some cases. In other cases, you know, again, we already talked about performance potential issues here, that there may be other tools that could potentially speed it up or whatever. I just remember somebody recently saying, well, I had it just write, instead of having an object relational mapper, an ORM kind of system, I had it just write the core SQL stuff and so forth. And it had a bit of a performance boost, but at the end of the day, he was still having a hard time understanding the code out of it. So, like, there's going to be a balance there. Yeah.
It's going to be a balance, because you're not going to say, hey, just write everything in assembly and have done with it. You know, sure, that's the best, most performant way of doing it. But, you know, we are all humans trying to understand the code that's being written, and we're ultimately responsible for what's going out there and getting released. And, you know, we have to do the code reviews, and we have the ultimate responsibility. If something breaks, we're the ones who have to fix it. And if it's just, you know, bytecode, or if it's, you know, something, if it's the low-level SQL that we just can't follow without having that ORM wrapper on top, then, you know, it's going to be a struggle. Yeah, so, you know, my experience is it's good to have some layers in there. Mm-hmm. So you're not just going down to the lowest possible layer, but, you know, the fewer the better.
Yeah.
And adding them for reason, you know, having that reason to add them because you want to understand it better, or that's a valid reason, you know, and there's trade-offs with everything.
You already kind of mentioned some of the background on all the new frameworks coming in, but as a technical lead, were you seeing engineers stacking lots and lots of libraries. And
100%.
Was that a difficult conversation to say, hey, there might be performance issues here?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, it's very easy to find a library to, you know, have a problem to solve and just do a search and say, hey, is there something that solved this problem already? And, you know, 90% of the time there is something that solved the problem already.
Yeah.
And so you think, hey, just import this and use this and great, solved my problem. You know, I've delivered a feature in 1 week that probably would have taken me 4 weeks if I, you know, spent the time and written it myself. So, you know, that's valid, you know, that's
right.
That's saving time. You know, companies love that you save time and money. But ultimately, some of those libraries will be great and will be absolutely fine to use. And some of them just won't at all. And it's having the time to look through the libraries and, you know, investigate what it is that they're actually working, you know, how they're solving the problems.
Yeah.
And then finding out, you know, what they're actually doing, what, you know, the way that they're working, is it something that's not very performant or is it something that's, you know, had I written it myself, this is probably the way I would have done it in the best way. And that education amongst the team is very, like, very important. And having people understand that, not to just choose something because it solves the problem, but to understand how it's solving the problem. And, you know, and thinking for yourself, like, objectively, is this the best way? Are there other options out there that are lighter, you know, that don't take up as much? Well, in JavaScript world, when you ship a new library into the front end, it's quite a lot of extra data. Your bundle size, your JavaScript file gets bigger and bigger, and, you know, that everything kind of waits for that JavaScript to download and parse before you get the experience. So ultimately you're having a knock-on effect on the rendering time as well. So that's something that, you know, you want to affect. And you can move stuff to the server side, and that's great, and do as much as you can there and send less to the client to render in the browser, and that's good. But, you know, you're just offloading one problem onto another, and you know you're just moving it
around.
And you know, ultimately you should just be asking yourself, is there a better way of solving this problem? Like, I could have done it myself, or that strips it down to the bare bones of just what it is that we're trying to solve, and just solve that problem instead of, you know, a bigger picture. Because most libraries, the longer they're around, the more features they add, and, you know, the more people have raised issues about this case and that case that aren't your particular use case, but, you know, solve valid problems for some people. And, you know, obviously as a library maintainer, you want to be able to support as many people as possible. So you know, incorporate all of these extra PRs into your solution, and some of it has code that you won't run or ever come across. So, you know, unless you've got something that strips out everything that isn't being used, you're going to have to think very carefully about what it is that, you know, the code's doing, and you know, just take the bits you want.
Yeah. I think we'll talk about this more, but I feel like when that engineer adds that library and has added that feature, are they in the practice of then testing the performance after that?
Well, that's the thing. And that's the thing that I've been trying to teach as well. This whole idea of, you know, how do you know when something is unperformant? Or, you know, how do I know that I've introduced a performance regression and when I've added this library? Ultimately, it comes down to, like, having thought about it in advance about what your kind of performance goal is. So, like, what it is that the business, usually it's down to the business, like what the business are trying to achieve with whatever feature it is I'm trying to do. So say I'm building a checkout API or something, and it's, you know, this is something that if people buy something online and they go through the checkout API right at the end, and the performance of that is going to affect how customers feel about the experience of buying on that website or app or whatever. And so,
and potentially abandoning it entirely.
Exactly.
Which I have done.
And same here. Absolutely. Same here. Yeah. So, you know, that, so the business might say, okay, that checkout API mustn't take any longer than 500 milliseconds, for example, because anything longer is going to be a noticeable effect to the user. And, you know, that's going to have negative, people reflect negatively on the business. So, you know, there's a goal right there. And from there, you can take that and create a performance budget. So very similar kind of thing. It's essentially the goal, but with a little bit of headroom in it to allow for you to, you know, occasionally go over the budget a little bit and kind of just hover around that point. So say it was 500 milliseconds and you want to aim for like 450 or something with what you've got. So you've got to do, obviously, measurement of how long your endpoint is taking. And you can do this in development. You can do this in production as well. absolutely keep that information in your logs and stuff so you can feed that back into the system. So sticking to a budget, and when I add a library to that API endpoint, or I want to, you know, add a new payment provider into that, for example, and that new payment provider is slower than the others and it has an impact on performance, you know, what do I do at that point? You know, that's going to break my budget, and the ultimate business goal is going to get broken at that point. Do I go back to the supplier of that payment endpoint and work with them on making it faster? Or do I try and, you know, account for it in hours and try and make tweaks to hours? And there's only, you know, a certain amount you can do. So yeah, having the ability, I think, to occasionally break the budget with that raised up to, you know, management, and that they understand that we're going to try and fix this problem, but we want to release this feature. So, you know, having this kind of like, so we've had the headroom beneath the goal, have a kind of headroom above there as well that says, you know, occasionally we're going to allow ourselves to go over.
Okay.
As long as, you know, these things have to happen straight afterwards. So the things that need to be flagged and they need to be documented, and we need to plan into, you know, sprint, you know, the next sprint or the sprint after that, that we're going to deal with this, you know, within, you know, this amount of time, and we're going to get it back within that headroom at that point. And, you know, document the things that need to happen for that goal to be reached again. So I need to reach out to this, you know, payment provider and work with them on a better solution, or we need to implement better caching or something like that, that gets you back down beneath that line. So it's all about having like goals and budgets, but not getting to the point where they are so prescriptive that you refuse to allow new features to go out because one might slightly break,
right?
You know, slightly go over the line. Obviously, you might get the case where things go drastically over the line and you need to think of something completely different to do. We had a case where actually we were working with a payment provider, and it was one of those payment provider systems that they use in like stores and stuff. So, you know, if you're sitting down at a bank, for example, and they're saying, you know, I want to take out a loan, you know, they've got a computer system where you type in the numbers and then they press the button, and then you're sitting there waiting for like 10, 20 seconds for an answer to come back from the system with like, you know, a price for your loan or whatever.
Yeah.
So we were trying to integrate a system like that into an online checkout system where we could get an updated price before, you know, there's people making changes on the website. We wanted to update the price. But each time we were making changes, it was taking 20 seconds to get a new reply from this system. So it was not a very good experience at all.
Wow.
So we needed to obviously document like what the problem was, that, you know, obviously went way over our budget at the time, how long we were going to be able to live with it before we ultimately fixed the problem. So in the case of that problem, we knew we were going to be able to cache the data. We just didn't have the resources available on the team, enough team members to be able to build the caching system to preemptively select like the most common options and stuff and on the system to be able to cache them on our side. So yeah, we knew that was going to happen, but that would be like 2 months down the line or something. So in the meantime, we had to make changes to the user experience to try and like mitigate the effect on the user a little bit. Yeah, we know they won't be able to get the price immediately, but maybe they'll be able to get some other information and stuff. So they're making changes. We can make sure that the UI updates, you know, in real time so that feels as if it's responsive, and, you know, have a little skeleton loader or a little loading spinner for the price as a kind of temporary measure before we resolve the main issue. So
you knew there was activity there. The customer could say, okay, I can see there's something moving here.
Exactly. Yeah. So they could see, you know, they weren't feeling like they were dragging sliders and suddenly they had to wait 20 seconds for the price to come back before they could start dragging it again. They knew they could drag around, and, you know, if they started making new selections, we could cancel old like requests made to the server to get the prices and just deal with the most recent one.
Yeah.
And a lot of things are about, you know, perceived performance and about trying to make the experiences feel as smooth as possible, even if underlying that is something a lot slower. So yeah, we had a crazy problem with that. But, you know, ultimately we fixed the problem. It's really smooth now. And yeah, it's just documenting it, knowing when it's going to happen, escalating to the business that we know this is a problem. It's because of this. It's not because, you know, we're bad developers or anything like that. But this problem will be fixed in, you know, X amount of time. And we'll get back there.
Yeah. Maybe we can start with sort of defining fast by default. Also, we should probably mention that you have a book.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we even got there yet. That is, you know, literally titled Fast by Default, Practical Performance Engineering. It's on Manning and currently available in the Manning Early Access Program, which I've talked about before on the show. So people are interested, and we'll have links for that stuff. Which came first? Was the title there first? Was your ideas around that, or was it developed as you started writing?
No, the ideas and the title, I guess, well, the ideas came first. So that was just me making a whole bunch of notes and documenting things as real performance issues came up. It was clients that I've worked on over the last 15 years or something. And I came to the point where I thought, I've got a lot of these notes. Like, what should I do with them? You know, it feels like, you know, it's a waste to just have them sitting there on my hard drive and not like share them with the world. Do I just write a whole bunch of blog posts or what do I do? What should I do with this? It feels like it's a shame to waste because I can see other people are having performance problems and they're not adopting these techniques. So what should I do with it? And so I thought, I think I'm gonna write a book. I've written two books before, years ago on JavaScript.
Okay.
So I knew I had it in me to do it. So like I kind of just started like structuring something together, like how might one kind of teach all these different things in what order, and you know, how to kind of define it in a way that it is a kind of like framework that's all one kind of thing. You know, the name came all the way at the end of that, like Fast by Default was came about because of things like, you know, Resilience by Default and all these other like by defaults that there are in the world of like the techniques to take to, you know, improve various different aspects of software development and user experience. And I looked around and I was like, why is there nothing for performance specifically? That seems like a bit of an oversight. I certainly would have really appreciated having that knowledge written down, but at the time I was experiencing all these issues. So I thought, let's call it Fast by Default and then just see what happens. And so I pitched it to Manning, and the original idea was it was going to be a web performance book, because obviously, like, you know, we've been talking about web is my history, and you know, having written books on JavaScript before, I thought this is a great area where I could write a specific performance book on.
The nooks and crannies of exact places where these things happen, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But then I realized I am actually teaching something that's more kind of like general than just web. You know, when I'm talking about performance goals and budgets, that's not something that's just unique to the web world. That's any kind of software development, and that's performance that relates to anything. And when I was going to write about like profiling, that's obviously not just something in the web world. It's something reasonably new in the web world. Like people write JavaScript.
I want to talk to you about that too. I'm familiar with the Python ones because, again, I've been watching a lot of people focusing on this. In fact, they're adding a very elaborate one in 3.15. It even has a name. I can't remember its name right now. They're really thinking about it. And I thought about like flame graphs and where memory goes and, you know, things that try to keep the profiler from causing a bloat in and of itself inside there. And like, what is it looking at and being able to identify where the problems are? I would guess there would be a similar growth in quality, hopefully, of these tools. Is that your experience in the web world?
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely. And I have to say credit to Google for Chrome, because they've added a lot of tools into this development tools bar that you can get at the bottom of your browser. Okay. So it's like a developer menu hidden within Chrome. And if you enable it, you get this whole half of the screen at the bottom is just focused on development tools. And the whole section of it is to do with performance. And like you were saying with flame graphs, it maps the JavaScript usage, the memory usage. We talk about DOM nodes a lot in the front end. And these are every individual element that's on the page, basically. So a title or an image or something like that. Each one is a DOM node, and it keeps track of how many DOM nodes you have. The more DOM nodes, the less, you know, the faster the experience is in the browser, because it has to keep track of all the DOM nodes. And, you know, whether those DOM nodes stick around after they shouldn't do. So we have garbage collection in JavaScript. But if there's like a reference that hasn't been closed properly to a DOM node or something, then that DOM node stays in memory. And if you're running like a web application that isn't designed to be closed down, then, you know, you keep it up for hours, then those things accumulate over time and you end up with a slower and slower experience as you go along.
Yeah.
If you've ever used like well, Facebook, Slack, things like this in the browser, and you probably keep them up for a long time. You know, those teams have had to focus a lot of time on performance for exactly that reason, and freeing up memory and tracking what's being used and event listeners in the browser, yeah, and how they hook onto elements and repeated things on timers that sometimes, if the thread gets blocked, can sometimes happen at the same time as each other, and conflict and things like this. And so these developer tools in Chrome, and they have them in Safari and Firefox, not as advanced as the ones in Chrome, but they are pretty good and getting better.
That's nice.
So these allow you to profile code and see exactly where things are going wrong, and you can, you know, really drill down on, you know, what functions have been called and how often loops are running, and, you know, which elements in the browser have been hooked onto for too long and things like that. So yeah, the tools are there, but I found that a lot of people don't know how to use them because they are,
yeah,
you know, these are newish, or new at least in terms of the level of granularity you're able to go down to now, and people don't know this. And because there's that learning curve, you know, I wanted to kind of teach that in my book, and as I work with people as well about that, and obviously profiling, you know, the same ideas of flame graphs and memory usage there across everything. You know, I've been, yes, doing a little bit of development, iOS development as well, and, you know, similar tools exist there for you know, for creating flame graphs and tracking memory usage and things like that. And, you know, why not use them? So, and why not use them while you're developing instead of waiting until, you know, you're on your staging server, or you're later on in the, yeah, in, yeah, the process, and you finally realize, I've got memory usage is scaling up, and I had no idea why, and I don't know what's going on.
You mentioned in a couple different places this idea of profiling, and you kind of have it as a daily task, which I thought was really fascinating. But if you were to introduce something in a particular day and then profile it, you aren't like being like a week or 2 weeks away from like realizing, well, where did that happen? Like you know it is within this time period of this chunk of code, this diff, if you will, mm, where this has happened. Is that part of the reason for wanting to profile daily?
It is, absolutely, yeah. And so, you know, when I say daily, I don't necessarily mean, you know.
Yeah, I understand that. I get that. Yeah,
exactly. But while you're working on something specific and ideally small, to profile at the end of that, or, you know, while it's going on is ideal. And to get as much information as you can while you're developing is really the goal there. And yeah, it's all about
measure as you go.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the main thing, yeah, about performance, isn't it? Measuring, and, you know, measuring that you have a performance problem. A lot of people I hear come to me and say, oh, my site's really slow. And I'm like, okay, is it slow? Do you know that for sure? They say it feels slow. People complain that it feels slow, but yeah, until you measured, do you actually know that it's slow? You know, right, it could be something, some other factor like the machine or the network or something like that. So, you know, measurement is the key thing. And that's really the thing with profiling, isn't it? It's just measurement, but at that really granular level of where the code is that you're writing at the time. And yeah, it is all about feeding that back earlier, because the hardest thing I find in focusing on performance in code is leaving things too late that you can't go back and easily fix it. Because once you've added, you know, one feature, another feature, and re-architected or rewritten some parts of the code, and then you find out that there's a performance problem, going back to that first feature and making a change that other things are then built on top of is hugely disruptive, or can be hugely disruptive depending on the size of it.
To both sides of the, yeah, situation there, if customers like the feature or have gotten used to it, and if the developers have a hard time like being able to wrangle that. Yeah,
absolutely. And one thing that I found for being a team lead as well is the developers really don't like it when what they have to do in a sprint is just focus on performance fixes and tweaks and bug fixing and things. Like, not that, you know, not everyone's as interested in performance as I am.
It's not as fun. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. It's not. And you know, it's, yeah, treated like it's a bug, and it is a bug. And those are way less interesting than working on features. And, you know, from business and engineering managers, they don't dislike it as well, because, you know, I'm now spending 2 weeks working on fixing a whole bunch of bugs that should have been right from the beginning, instead of building this new feature that's supposed to be launched next month or whatever. So yeah, that whole idea of doing it as you go along, before things get, you know, before things get built on top of it, and it becomes even harder to work through. That's really the whole reason for doing it daily or as frequently as you can. So yeah, profiling is super important.
And
having the habit of doing it, I think is, you know, I think some teams are better at it than others, and some, you know, I think in the backend world, it's something that's been around for a lot longer than it has in the front end world. So it's, you know, more ingrained into the way that development works there. Maybe you can tell me more about your experience there than I know, but that's the way I certainly see it from the other side.
Yeah, I think the architecture part that you stress, and that, you know, totally depends on where you're at and so forth, if you're literally standing something up, is such a crucial part of what you're kind of saying, like thinking about all the stuff in advance. And I think the default word is a really good word across the board here, like this idea of like, you aren't against the idea of prototyping. We had a conversation on the show a little while ago from somebody else's article, was that they're a trap in some cases, that if you build a prototype and then someone in higher management gets a chance to play with it, they think that you're done. Mm. And it's like, no, this is just to show you functionality and to kind of get like start a conversation and make sure that we're going to head in a correct direction. It's like, you know, laying out a, you know, the storyboards for a movie. It's like, well, we're not going to shoot pictures of the storyboards for the film. This is to get the idea and find mistakes and, you know, find if this is the right direction. But we're gonna have to go back and literally build a set and shoot this thing. And I feel like that's kind of a weird trap that people then try to use that code. And it's like, no, we need to kind of, and so it's like waking people up to those ideas. It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. Do you want to optimize the performance of your Python program to make it run faster or consume less memory? This course is titled Profiling Performance in Python. It's based on a Real Python tutorial by Bartosz Jaczynski, and the video course is presented by Nagar Vahid. This course digs into several areas of advice. Before diving into any performance tunings, why should you consider software profiling? Determining if the effort to refactor will take longer to improve the code than the amount of times you'll run it. Using a profiler to learn where your program consumes memory and ways to make it more efficient. And how to use several Python tools to measure the performance of your code, including TimeIt, cProfile, pStats, and PyInstrument. As a precursor to checking out the video course, here's a short checklist to figure out whether you need to work on performance. Testing. Have you tested your code to prove that it works as expected and without errors? Refactoring. Does your code need some cleanup to become more maintainable and Pythonic? And then profiling. Have you identified the most inefficient parts of your code? Like most of the video courses on Real Python, this course is broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, you get code examples for the technique shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. You have lots of these lists, and I think they're kind of interesting. Like you have a system is fast by default when, and then you have like a list of these things. And you have a website, fastbydefault.com, all together as one big word. A lot of these ideas are there, so if people want to revisit them and think about them, I think they're pretty good. I don't know, would you like to kind of go through some of them, like some of these like core ideas? Like we're kind of just kind of touching on them, but like where do you feel like is a good place for people to kind of start? You have like seven principles. Where do you want to dig into?
Yeah, and I mean, it's hard when you know, if you go to the site, it's like a big list of things.
It's a lot of stuff.
And you're like, okay, where do I actually start? And that's why it's kind of good with the book, because, you know, you read it from beginning to end and, you know, I go into detail on each of the things here.
Yeah.
You know, I have it in a kind of like rough order anyway.
It's funny because I have a lot of people write these books where they'll literally say, you can read this in whatever order that you want. And I kind of don't feel that as much here. I mean, you could come back to it in that way, but in some ways you want to introduce people to a new methodology to start with this in mind. And then these are the things that kind of flower out of it. But like, there is kind of a core introduction to the concepts.
Exactly. Yeah. So in the book, the first few chapters, I'd say probably the first four chapters really are talking about concepts and the idea, the framework and how to, you know, what performance, why performance is important. That's like the first chapter.
Yeah.
And the second one is all about, you know, how to convince your boss and their boss and their boss's boss that it's important to focus on performance, which yes, I think is really important, because, you know, you can be like the most, you know, passionate person about performance and say, we need to make this faster or whatever. But unless you talk in the kind of language that, you know, the VP understands, then they're not going to say, yeah, let's dedicate some time and some budget to doing this, you know. So you have to talk in terms of like how much it's going to cost them if we don't do this, and how much
ROI or whatever.
ROI is really important. Yeah, you know, they talk about that all the time, and that is really important. And you know, losing customers is pretty much the big one when it comes to performance. And like we were talking about trust,
yes,
and you know, slow experiences, they degrade your trust in the system as a customer, and you know, that means a lost customer. And you know, there's some things about performance, like when it comes to like mobile apps, you have to download the whole mobile app to your device before you use it.
Yes.
And, you know, if you don't have the space on your device, then you don't download it. But as a business, you don't know that someone didn't download your app, because you only have the statistics about when people did download your app. So, you know, you have to do a little bit of research and stuff as well, and like compare against competition. Like, you know, this competitor has, you know, 50% smaller bundle size on their app, and so, you know, we think that's why that they have, you know, X more customers than we do, for example. So, you know, framing it in terms of trust and in terms of how much time that customers are going to get back versus the time it's going to spend to do the development work, and, you know, ultimately how much money they're going to make, that's the big one.
Yeah.
And so framing it in terms of those languages. So, you know, before we get to talk about any like, you know, how to actually profile your code or things like this, you know, this is all really important stuff. And so,
yeah, it's a big conversation. I can see, all the different angles of potential pushback, you know, from all parties.
Yeah, absolutely. So it is really important. And so it's important to...
To put a flag in the ground is going to be hard here.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's like a really key like focus that I want people to understand before we get into all the nitty-gritty of the code stuff. And then, you know, then we talk about performance goals like we were talking about. That comes partially from the business and partially from the team as well, about what they think that, you know, what is good enough when it comes to performance of what you're building.
Yeah.
You know, how to document that and how to get a number and not just arbitrarily pick, you know, I want this to respond.
Yeah, I've never heard of it as a budget, a performance budget. Yeah. That is a really interesting idea, that like, where is it acceptable here? Like initial load, this is somewhat acceptable, versus like a payment screen. Like this, that's got to be tight and not stopping somebody and having them have a second thought. Potentially, that's a dark pattern. I don't know. But I feel like as long as it's where the areas need to be smoothed and where stuff needs to be sanded. And I think that budgeting is really interesting.
Yeah. And it's really key to keep you on track later on. So that's why it's so important to understand it and to define that stuff early on before you start optimizing your code, because you know you need to have something to optimize against and a measurement that you're comparing against every time, right? So,
right,
you know, so that the work you're doing is deterministic, and you know, if it meets that goal, then it succeeds, and if it doesn't, then you know, conversations need to be had. And so part of that fits into like understanding this concept of critical paths and and that is essentially like broken down into what the user needs to do and how long is acceptable for them to take to do it. And that could be a long flow where they're like, you know, browsing a site for buying some clothes or whatever, and then, you know, taking them through to the checkout, and you know, how long is acceptable for the whole process end to end, and you know, what you need to do to optimize that process. And most of that optimization will usually be towards the end, but you want to make sure that you don't lose people on the way if it's a flow. So in terms of the web, that's the critical path there. A critical path on the back end is, you know, all the different systems that are connected together, the database and the network layer. And, you know, if you're jumping between from system to system, you know, how those systems are connected and how close they are to each other.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that's the idea of a critical path there. So the same kind of concept applies across a lot of it. And then after that, I start talking about architecture and about, you know, what the best kind of ways of writing your apps, and, you know, whether it's better with monoliths or microservices and things like that, and how to structure things. Then I start talking about turning those goals that we talked about earlier into those fixed budgets with the headroom on either side. And then I start talking about profiling, and then I start talking about build sizes and, you know, how much time issues are taking, like runtime issues, for example, like how long things are taking and how to find that out earlier on, how to surface that information to developers while they're developing and not later on.
Yeah.
So that's a very like a key point across the whole book, is trying to get the information to developers as soon as possible so that, you know, we don't have these problems later on. So then that naturally feeds into like code review and then like testing and feeding testing back from the real world into your application and into your team as well. And then about automation, CI/CD, and how you make sure that all the things that we've been teaching up to this point are gated so that, you know, things don't go out that break automation checks. So say you forget to profile one feature, and it makes its way through and, you know, it gets caught before it goes out. And then, you know, things happen after that, like over time, your stack might change. You might add, like we're talking about, extra libraries and things, and how to make sure that your application can stay performant.
Not regressing.
Exactly. You're not regressing, and how to review those things in the, you know, the idea of performance before you implement them into your system. Like one of the chapters later on is all about like team culture and about how performance is not a development problem. It's a team problem and it's an application problem and it's
a communication problem.
It's a communication problem, exactly. Yeah. And that everybody is involved, you know, even a designer, the testers, the business folks, the product managers and things like that. That everybody is on the same page when it comes to performance, and everybody knows that it's important, and everybody knows that this is something that we have to keep, you know, on a level keel, otherwise, you know, things are going to be bad for the business later on, and bad for us as team members as well.
Yeah.
And then the very end of the book, because I know a lot of people want to come to the book and say, I've got a problem, how do I solve it? So that the last few chapters of the book are about very specific kind of like, it's a cookbook kind of thing. There's recipes in there about, you know, I've got this problem, how can I solve it, basically? And then that's like
a bit of a flow chart, like where to look and
exactly
stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And Okay. Specific code as well, the bad way and the good way and these kind of things. And so,
okay, compare.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so that's the kind of thing end to end. And, you know, I think it flows because it's talking about, you know, what's important at each stage. And development is a massive chunk of that in the middle, but that's not the only thing. Just having that awareness from a team perspective and from a company perspective about what's important, I think is like, that's the key thing, having everyone on board, because otherwise you'll end up with someone, me, going into your application and being the one to fix all your performance problems, then going, and then, you know, you end up with the same situation again 6 months down the line. It's got to be something that everybody owns. It's got to be something that everybody sees as important. Otherwise, you know, it's no longer fast by default. It's just fast for a short time until the next thing comes along.
Right. You mentioned, we talked a lot about, you know, checkout windows and things like that and web performance and so forth, but you have a example, I think it's in maybe the first chapter, you're talking a little bit about Slack, and they had a problem with like, just like you're trying to type and it's taking a half a second for like a letter to appear. And that, yeah, you're just like, I'm going to close the window because this is like frustrating to no end. So it can be, those pain points may not be obvious to a developer beyond systematic testing of like, you know, unit testing and things like that. I'm guessing there are other, you know, QA types of steps that are in that are, again, part of that communication cycle of like saying, you know, how did we get here?
Yeah, exactly. And that's all a part of, there's the QA phase as well, the real testing, you know, but there's also the actual real world testing, which is everybody in the whole world using your application and, you know, feeding that information back through your logs or whatever reporting system that you have, so you know about it. So you can measure, you know, input latency and things like that. And for that kind of application, having a performance budget that's specifically about input latency is very important, you know, because that's one of the key things, you know, when the user is actually interacting with your application. It's that immediate response time that's so important. Like, I think it's about 200 milliseconds is about the response time. That anything below that, people feel like, yeah, the system is really responsive. And anything over that starts to raise questions in people's minds, like, is it slow or is it just me? You know, once you get past 300 milliseconds to 400 milliseconds, then people are like, it's a noticeable difference. And especially if you're trying to type, you know, you type fast. And if you're waiting for that cursor to follow you along the screen, like, that's just an absolute agony when you're someone who's writing all day, especially in an application like that where it's all about chat. So, you know, those Slack fixed that problem, you know, once they realized they got the feedback from users and then they started tracking input latency themselves. So created a whole system around it as well. That's something that I've tried to fit throughout the book, is small case studies like this where teams have done, teams have had this problem and dealt with it and the way that they've done it, because everybody fixes problems in slightly different ways. So sometimes it's useful just to see, you know, how Slack solved the problem or Shopify solved the problem with their API, and, you know, all these other teams that are out there who have had all these problems before, and like learning from them in the context of while we're learning about, you know, why performance goals are important, you know, what performance goals, you know, these other teams have, what, you know, what ones Netflix has, for example, and how that helps their development team work. And sometimes they're like anti-case studies. I'm not sure if you saw the ones about monoliths versus microservices, but you know,
I was going to ask you, like, what in the end, like, yeah, I've kind of lived through that conversation, but I feel like things have rotated back to more monolithic type of stuff, partly because of, I think it's partly a bit of a reliability thing, but also just like, it could be just literally a speed performance kind of thing, and then maintainability and so forth. But I don't know what is your experience. You've been way more out there in the trenches than I have, sitting on the sidelines here watching.
Well, the thing is, both work, and it really depends on like some architecture decisions. But it's a system thing. Obviously, you know, microservices, we're splitting the system up. So there's always that small communication pain with every connection between every other system. And so, you know, there's always that small chance that one system isn't started up, or, you know, there's, you know, we're going to have to use a load balancer to switch between. And then that's going to add a little bit of extra time for that one little microservice connection.
The latency's adding up.
Exactly. Yeah. The latency's adding up. And you don't get that obviously within the monolith system, but then you also get the problem is if monolith goes down, then, you
know, everything's down.
The monolith goes down. Yeah, exactly. So,
and you can't work on the individual components as maybe easily or
No, exactly. So there isn't one solution that's best, and there isn't one solution that's the right one and one that isn't. Yeah, I've seen, you know, a few years ago, everybody went down the microservices route. I've seen more people go back to the monolith route recently, but equally, I see so many people on microservices where it's working really well for them. And they have the kind of system that is ideal for that. So, yeah, there is no one right answer. And I try and present that in the book as well and say, you know, these are the trade-offs between the two, and, you know, which trade-offs are the ones that match your system, because those will be the ones that ultimately choose which route to go down. And I think it's useful having, like, I think I had an example of Amazon where they chose to take their monolith and split it into microservices. And it ended up disastrously, and everything, you know, performance was way worse afterwards. Mm. They suffered from the latency effect, and they went back to the monolith and, you know, just made tweaks and changes to the way that they were accessing their data and organizing things within that improved performance for them. You know, it's not always that.
It's so much harder to do late kind of the key theme I think you're presenting in the book.
Absolutely is. Yeah. That's it. It's painful at the end. So make it less painful throughout. You know?
Yeah. You have these questionnaire, and I kind of wanted to just maybe kind of quickly go through them. And then I thought about like some follow-up for them. You have this, do you catch performance problems during development rather than after release? And I think we've kind of touched on that a whole bunch. Are performance budgets defined and enforced automatically in CI? So that's really interesting. So like you're saying that there is going to be a test that is part of the integration step. Am I reading that right then?
That's right, yeah. So we're going to run as much as we can a simulation of the production environment in CI, and we're going to make sure that we're going to do the measurements there on a kind of realistic simulation of the machine it's going to run on, and you know, within financial constraints of how much you can run, you know, every time on a pull request. But yeah, we're basically going to discover that information at that stage, as well as developers doing it throughout. And obviously there's a tendency that developers get lazy and they just leave it to the automation stage to catch. But then you get the problem where things are more painful to fix afterwards. So I think you'll find that. So, and something that kind of semi-related to that is what we're talking about, budgets. And like I try and have like a PR template that I use where you report what the metrics are that you've been measuring and profiling locally, and you present it in that. So to kind of prove to the other team members that you have been doing that work, and these are the before and after numbers, and they could go up and down or whatever they do, but just to show that you've been doing it, and that acts as another kind of another gate before we get to the automation part of it. So I think that's all really important. But basically simulation.
I think that kind of goes to this next question coming up with the, do developers see the performance impact of their changes as they work, which is kind of what you're saying there, like the profiling locally, if you will, and looking at that performance there.
And there's another thing with that as well. Like profiling is brilliant, but for some systems, especially visual ones like the web, like apps, sometimes it's important for developers to see in real time within that app what the performance impact is on the changes. So you can measure things like frame rate and things like that within the browser.
Any video game person would be very familiar with this sort of performance stuff right away. Yeah,
absolutely. That's exactly where the idea came from. So in some of the later chapters, I talk about having like a a heads up display on your application so that you can see at a glance as you're using it what performance is like, and you can see like red flags coming up saying that they were already,
here's input latency over here, here's redraw or what have you.
And so that's really good, because the stuff that you don't catch in code you can catch when you're doing testing. And testers can bring up this same display as well on their machines too, and just kind of try and break the system and see where are the points where latency gets too long, or the points where the frame rate drops sufficiently that it's affecting the experience, and those will then feed you into looking at the flame graphs and seeing what's happening at that point where those happen, and digging down and profiling then.
Yeah. And the last one you have is like, do you run regular cleanup cycle that removes the dead code and unnecessary complexity? And we've talked about this before. Like, this is one of these big, big, big steps of becoming a professional. Like, you developing code, on your own, and you moved this idea of working with a team, but then this idea of like owning the code, making sure that it's extensible, it can be expanded upon and can grow. But then also, like, are you regularly like pruning it and keeping care of it? I think that's a really interesting step, and it made me think about this idea of like, okay, what are the areas out of the stuff that we talked about? You touched it a little bit, but like, where do you get pushback on this stuff?
Pushback does come, and it's usually in terms of how long things are taking.
Okay.
Because adding in profiling into development means that you're not delivering X feature to the server within the same amount of time that it would have done if you hadn't done profiling.
Right.
And so, pushback can come at that stage. The questions start coming in about how long it's taking. That, I think, inevitably leads to, is this even important to do? And going back to that exact same question we had like earlier on in the book, is it important to focus on that? Because, some people in the business will say, it's more important that we get this feature out because this feature helps us sell more, whatever it is they're selling.
Right. There's going to be a headline on the website. We have this.
Yeah. So this is something major. We just want to get it out there and get it working. And you're saying, oh, I can't do it because I need to spend, the next 4 hours profiling something that I built. And I don't know, if I'm going to have to then feedback, do some more work on it before it's good enough. So pushback does come then. I try and refer them back to the that original discussion about, you know, ultimately this is offsetting more pain later.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, this is more about, yeah, taking those little hits rather than the big one later on.
It's hard to get people to think about the future.
Yeah, exactly. It always is. Yeah. But, you know, in terms of that budget and allowing yourself to go over, as long as there's a plan to go back under again later and to say, okay, well, you know, if we're going to give up on this now because we have to get this out this week, then these are the figures that we have. They're above our budget, but here's the plan to get within that within the next, you know, sprint or two and get it back down there. And to have that, you know, have those tasks in, you know, in your Jira or Linear or whatever to make sure those actually happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And to, you know, show that there's a plan for getting it back to that baseline that you'd already agreed on. So yeah, pushback does happen, sadly. And yeah, that's how I've found is the best way to handle that. And don't go along with the stress and pressure of trying to just, you know, satisfy the business needs just for the sake of, you know, a few hours or a couple of days.
Yeah, I'd like to flip that on its head a little bit. Like, what are things that are easier about kind of building this performance first team culture? Like, what's something that is a win that you can see easily?
Yeah, so I think in terms of like developer happiness, so like I think, you know, Dora, they produce these metrics every year about, they do a whole bunch of surveys of developers, how they're feeling about different aspects of working in software, what things are the most painful. And a lot of people report, you know, about things like burnout and things like that, because, you know, there's the constant stress at the end of the project to either fix or, you know, get things done by a certain deadline. And I think performance fits into that in terms of the way people have always done it, which is leaving everything to the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to make developers happier, you have to feed things in earlier on. And this is, you know, really the whole idea of like shift left and things like that that have come earlier, like bringing things as early as possible so that they can be fixed before they happen later. And so Fast by Default is kind of an extension of that idea, but spread out all the way along rather than just everything at the beginning. And so, yeah, I think that's really what it's all about.
Yeah, yeah. So when I have authors on, often I think about the depth they go into of writing something like this. And I feel like occasionally they'll discover something new. They'll have an insight while writing the book. Do you have an insight that you had while writing this book?
Yeah, quite recently, actually. So this is more front-end focused, but I've been writing a section in the book about soak testing and other things about load testing and things like that. So about trying to catch memory problems by running the application over a long period of time. And on the back end, that's usually about firing a whole bunch of activity at your API endpoints and seeing what memory leaks over time. And in the front end, it doesn't quite work the same way because you're running in one browser some JavaScript code over a long period of time and people are interacting with it. And you only notice slowdowns from over a really long period of time. So it could be several hours. And only then do you see the memory leaks happen.
Okay.
So I've been trying to, like, I had a kind of epiphany that soak testing in that regard in the browser isn't about load and isn't about like bombarding the system in that regard. It's about speeding up all the interactions that could possibly happen in the front end and squeezing them down and compressing them to a short period of time. So you see really quickly the way that the memory graph is going. So, you know, instead of, you know, someone, you know, typing, let's say we're talking about Slack and chat interfaces, someone types in a long message and presses send, and then they click here and they click around to this different channel and they go back and they type another message. And so, like, basically essentially recording that activity but playing it back really fast and just seeing the memory graph spike, then you can trace it down through the profiling to find out exactly what it was about that caused the issue.
What's the spikiness?
Yeah, exactly. Where's that coming from? Is it, yeah, you know, I talked earlier about DOM nodes and elements on the page. Are there ones that are being left behind as people click around that should have been cleaned up, and is garbage collection happening fast enough, and the scope of variables and things like that? So that was a kind of epiphany I had about it. And I wrote a blog post about it recently and it got some good kind of traction in the community.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, oh yeah, I haven't thought about it like this before. And, you know, instead of just thinking about it like load, which is how we typically think about, you know, measuring memory, we fire as much traffic as we can at something and then seeing how its memory performs. Like firing as much traffic in the front end is really about firing as much user activity to the page as possible and seeing what happens and what comes back.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of a stress test of a sort.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly what it is.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Did you find something really difficult to put into words that you struggled with so far? I know you're not completed, so, but...
No, there's still a few chapters to go, but yeah, like, well, there's been plenty, really. Like, in general, it's been like 10 years or more since I wrote my last book, and I hadn't been blogging much until very recently, so it's all kind of like just way back there in my memory, just like get the kind of muscle memory of like writing stuff down and structuring sentences and things like that. So there's been a lot of stuff, like the architecture chapter in particular. I think that's like, that's probably the longest chapter of the book right now. I don't know how many pages it is, but it's like 60 or something like that. It's kind of long.
Yeah.
There was a lot to get in there and to kind of compress it down without losing any meaning and like trying to structure it in a way that, you know, it's interesting enough for someone who's focused on the front end to read about something that's to do with the back end and something people who are writing, you know, mobile apps to read about the front end as well. Because my whole concept is that this is a full stack problem performance. It's not just a front end problem or a back end problem. It's everything. It's the way that all the software fits together, the whole stack from the network up to the user. So it's all about optimizing all the different parts of that. And so full stack developers will get a lot out of this. But I think that people who are just back end developers, just front end developers will as well. And to try and make those other sections where it's not their main focus be as entertaining is the wrong word, but as engaging as possible.
Yeah.
So that they don't kind of drift off during those sections. That's probably been the hardest part.
Yeah. I was thinking about that with the conversation where Python developers, their stuff may be the backend stuff. It may be fast API. It may be, you know, these different tools like this, or they could be doing, you know, other stuff. And then I have a lot of people that are, you know, data scientists that would be looking at this stuff, but in a similar way, you still want to look at like, okay, architecture, what are you using? Are you running this thing locally? Are you using a web service to do all your testing? You know, where can you find architectural in the tools that you're using? Where can you find these wins? And so I think that's a really kind of a cool part of the conversation. I'm glad to talk about it.
Yeah.
I have one other odd question for you, but we mentioned it at the top where we talked a little bit about, you know, people are using LLMs to do a lot of development. And the wrinkle that I'm wondering about based upon the book is, well, do they write performant code?
Great question.
Or is that something that you have to put into that? Like, how do you prepare for that? Or is that part of your thought process at all? I'm adding a chapter to your book.
No, it's fine. I do actually go into this in the book.
Okay.
I haven't done like the dedicated AI chapter because I think that's just wrong.
Yeah, sure.
Like AI fits into the process, you know, the whole process. And the more that LLMs are able to do and more agents are able to go into different systems and start doing things for you, I think that's going to grow over time. So I didn't want to be like, yeah, this is what the system can do and that's it.
Right.
So yeah, but so by default, I mean, LLMs, they focus more on like correctness and whether tests pass, whether unit tests pass. And so that might, you know, that they don't spin up an old mobile device from 10 years ago and try the system on that and, you know, see if it works. You know, they don't have the concept of trying things out on different hardware that might represent what your users have or what where you're deploying things. So that's really interesting.
They want to answer the question and mark a check mark.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's absolutely what they want to do. Sometimes they'll come up with a decent performance solution and sometimes they won't. And so for me, it's been worth doing like second passes over things when I've been coding and saying, okay, you know, we've got this working, tests are passing, but let's have a think about performance. Like list me out all the areas that could potentially be a problem when it comes to performance, when this is deployed and in the hands of real users. And then, you know, there's a lot of information out there on the web and various different places and books and stuff about this. So, you know, it's consumed a lot of data about this. It's just because that focus initially is just about getting the code done, getting it written, right, and test passing, that it's not got that focus. But usually a second pass or a third pass can help you get there.
Okay.
So in terms of code review as well, like there's some pretty good AI code review agents out there as well, that some really good tools. Some are a bit more focused on performance than others. And so those can be a good thing to have plugged into your PRs and doing that kind of extra check at the end for you for things that you missed during development. So those are really useful as well. Like I would say they're not a complete substitute for, you know, being a human in this whole world of development right now, but you know, maybe they will be one day. But I think it's that feedback loop of, you know, the LLM not seeing how that this system or application is being used in the real world or will be used in the real world, and being able to feed that back. So if you have real world data that you can apply, then import that into your LLM.
I've been seeing that in different systems, like DSPy, having like these things that are, if you're writing a prompt, like, okay, we'll give it these results. And I was thinking about your budget. Like, I don't know if that's something you could inject in that and say, like, this is important. These are the important phases of this, and this is what I'm allotting. I don't know if that's, you know, I guess it depends on the sophistication of, at this point, probably like a whole harnessed out thing that, you know, looks at it. But it seems like they're all about getting code out there in some ways, and potentially, you know, helping with reviewing things, and feels a little more in the prototype area. So I feel like it's something that you could mistake and skip.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you've got to be aware of it as someone using these tools. Like, you know, the first step is correctness, and the second step is performance. And yeah, feed in your budgets, feed in any real world data that you have into the system, and, you know, have it use that to optimize, but just be careful not to over optimize and, you know, and, you know,
the whole premature thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually looking at that quote recently.
Is that kind of like painting into a corner in a way? Like, you just kind of like, okay, I'm like, I'm cutting off all these different angles that I could look at performance because I've, you know, painted it in a way that I'm stuck, you know, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just on that premature optimization quote, I read that that or a bit of that paper the other day, and read what came immediately afterwards, which is really interesting. So he was talking about micro optimization specifically there, actually. Like, but one of the next comments that he had in the paper was really interesting, and it was like, I think that compilers should build in a way to present performance figures and measurements into the compiling stage so that the developer can see that and then feed that back into their development work. And I thought that was so interesting. Like, I hadn't never seen that before, but it's kind of like the kind of concept that I have with this book.
That early on thinking about this dashboard. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So that was super interesting. I was like, well, okay, this is from like the '70s or something. And you know, thinking about it back then, and okay, we're still suffering from some of the same problems now that we were back then. Let's hope that, you know, over the next 50 years that we can improve things. Maybe my book can help, who knows? We'll see.
Yeah. So I like to ask people who come on the show a handful of questions here. And the first one is, what's something that you're excited about that's happening in the world of Python? And I know it's not your main focus. But...
Yeah, no, it's not. But actually, I read something recently. I think actually you probably mentioned it before on the show, but when Simon Willison was talking about combining MicroPython with WASM and running sandboxes in the browser.
I had that on the show recently.
I saw that. Yeah, but it's really interesting the way that like worlds combine, the worlds come into contact with each other. And I've always loved this idea of like sandboxing inside the browser and, you know, having that environment that's locked down that you don't have when you run things on your system. So yeah, I thought it was really interesting. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing like that extended and more ideas like that coming through. And WASM is really great for that, for combining things written in other languages and running it within a sandbox. That's super interesting. And I think that's, I definitely want to watch. I'm going to be watching it anyway.
Watch that space, yeah. Yeah. So what's something that you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be programming related.
Oh yeah, something we'll next. Well, I have a whole bunch of like synths and keyboards and stuff locked away in a cupboard here that I haven't dusted out for ages. I used to be a DJ and play records and stuff for many years ago, and bought a whole bunch of equipment at the time, and it's all just sitting in a suitcase in the closet. So I want to take that out and get back to learning more about waveforms and things like that. I've got some old ones where you can
actually synthesis,
you know, really turning the dials and affecting the sound and stuff. So I really love that idea.
There's a good course that I found that I might share with you.
Oh, yeah.
That goes through it. And it actually has an on-screen synth that you then, you know, it says, okay, make a sound that does this, and then you're like literally adjusting it, and you're like really kind of get that feedback loop of like, well, let's reduce it just to like three knobs as we then expand and so forth. Because yeah, synthesis is pretty wild, and it's gotten way more advanced. And I agree. I think, you know, making, you know, just touching knobs and playing with stuff, it's a lot of fun, as you can see behind
me. Yeah, exactly. I see all your equipment, and yeah, that made me think of it actually. So yeah, so that's cool. Something I want to get into and learn a bit more about. Yeah.
Awesome. What's the best way that people can follow your work online?
Oh, yeah. So, well, I'm on LinkedIn, Den O'Dell, but you can also find me on my website, denodell.com. I blog about performance and about other things that I care about as well.
Yeah. That soak test on there recently, right?
Yeah, that's so. Right. Yeah, exactly. So that's my most recent post. But yeah, I write about other things as well, like accessibility and a lot of stuff to do with how users interface with products and stuff. So, but yeah, performance is a big thing, obviously, I've been writing about recently, and has been a kind of thread over the last kind of year that I've been blogging again. So yeah, find me on there and denodell.com, and yeah, see if you like it.
Well, Dan, it's been really fun talking to you. Thanks for coming on the show.
You too, Christopher. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to thank Den O'Dell for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player, or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.